491.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded and produced for WVUD and our podcast listeners by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. The opinions represented in this program by hosts or guests do not necessarily reflect those of WVUD, the University of Delaware, or my own political campaign committee. Episodes are available for download on Tuesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes or Stitcher. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it simultaneously from WVUD.org on Tuesdays at 12:30 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is the Arsenal for Democracy.
This land is your land. This land is my land. California to the New York Island. Redwood forest, Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy, episode 323, recorded on September 6th, 2020. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Returning back on the line from Idaho is Rachel. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, Bill. Glad to be back.
Well, Rachel, the summer is coming to a close, and WVUD had graciously allowed us to go back to an hour-long format for the summer to keep people occupied during the lockdown. But we've got folks coming back onto the radio station with more shows, more programming, right after our time slot. So we are going to be returning to a half-hour time slot. Today, we're going to be talking about the Pinkertons National Detective Agency and some of its sort of successor entities and its impact on both the past and the present. As a result of us going back to the half-hour format, we have had to split some of the content. So we are basically going to be doing a two-part episode on the Pinkertons, focusing on two different areas. Obviously, there's a lot of overlap between these areas, but we're going to be talking about sort of armed guard and strike-breaking functions, as well as their infiltration of labor unions and how that relates to, today's corporate efforts to try to prevent unionization, which is sort of one of the ongoing legacies, even after the, armed violent clashes eras has diminished for the most part. But as a result of that, because I did a lot of the historical stuff and Rachel did a lot of the present day stuff, Rachel's not going to be talking as much on this episode, but she'll have more to say on the second part, just so people understand why I'm talking as much. We weren't initially expecting that we were going to be doing it this way. So let's jump right into it, Rachel. I think you are going to be hearing a lot of topics that we have touched on previously. There's going to be a lot of tiebacks and themes, and I would love to get your thoughts on that as we go along. But let's get into it. The primary source that I used for my research on this was this fantastic book published in 2016 by S. Paul O'Hara, and it's called, and it's a very long title because they're riffing on the like dime store detective novel sort of theme. The title is Inventing the Pinkertons, or Spies, Sleuths, Mercenaries, and Thugs, Being the Story of the Nation's Most Famous or Infamous Detective Agency. Now, I didn't read all of the book, but it is quite short, and it's very much from a leftist perspective, not just a liberal perspective, in my opinion on the book anyway. And I found it very interesting. He discusses a lot of different themes about the ways that the Pinkertons functioned and the tasks that they sort of performed. But let's talk about, from sort of the beginning of the book, some of his sort of thematic analysis. To challenge the Pinkertons was not only an act of defiance toward capitalism, progress, and industrial order, but also a criminal act. If corporate managers were the visible hand of the market, the Pinkertons were the market's visible fist. They were the shock troops of the industrial order. Between 1870 and 1937, they were the most visible element of capital's transformation and domination. They were the power and violence of capitalism at its most naked. If there were a single chattel principle to the 19th century industrialization, it would be this. Industrialists had the power to kill their workers. Dangerous working conditions, starvation wages, the testimony of detectives, or the force of hired gunmen were all symbols of this power. Many countries around the world during the same period were creating national police forces, but the United States, on the other hand, simply outsourced this role to the Pinkertons. In addition to private contracts for the capitalists, the Pinkertons were repeatedly hired by the U.S. government or other lower levels of government, such as states or cities and towns, to perform state functions, including with the post office and the treasury departments, and to wield the government's delegated monopoly on violence before that delegation of power was withdrawn in the Progressive Era following the Homestead Strike incident. This is why it's important to talk about the Pinkertons to understand American history and American capitalism specifically. So one reason that the federal government eventually rolled back the broad powers that it had been delegating or subcontracting to the Pinkertons was because progressive economic policy, according to the author of this book, S. Paul O'Hara, was essentially hostile to monopoly corporations, and monopoly corporations were the source of the Pinkerton contracts. They couldn't work for both the state and the capital once those two fell out of complete alignment. The Pinkertons, you know, they were this detective agency, but they were also marketing themselves as a way to keep an eye on criminal conspiracies and organized labor and things like that. Quote, the American public understood conspiracies as threats because Pinkerton agents held the power to define threats to society. So let's get into sort of how they emerged to take on this role beyond just sort of being glorified bounty hunters and private eyes and Abraham Lincoln's personal security force. The shift comes in the 1870s, and you can see this very clearly within some of the rhetoric and advertising that the company had put out during this time period. So Alan Pinkerton, the founder, back in the early days, he had had kind of a different perspective on labor, and he wasn't necessarily favorable toward labor unions, but it was more from this perspective of, you know, well, every man should have the right to go sell his individual labor and negotiate the best deal, etc. You know, and that was sort of the perspective. But as it became more of a financial imperative for the company to generate revenue, they started to turn toward these clients like the ones that subsequently would hire them to come up with the testimony to put the Haymarket bombers away. He pivoted during the 1877 railroad strike, which we discussed in episode 315, from a longstanding contention that criminal conspiracies basically did not exist, apart from the Molly Maguire's infiltration operation that he had begun in 1873 in Pennsylvania, which we also, I think, talked about on our Pennsylvania episode a little bit. And he had basically contended that all these criminal conspiracies that would become such an important part of the Pinkertons' business model, well, they didn't really exist. It was just public paranoia. And then suddenly, after the 1877 railroad strike, which we talked about previously, he's saying, no, the Pinkerton agency, not only are these real, but the Pinkertons can stop them. And this was a huge source of revenue after that point. In the early 1870s, he had kind of done this operation to disrupt the secret society of Irish miners and stuff in Pennsylvania, the so-called Molly Maguires. It's not even clear whether or not they really ever existed, but he had this whole infiltration scheme with this Irish guy to infiltrate their you know, communities and so forth and betray them and all that. And this sort of opened the door to, after 1877 and this railroad strike goes national and takes out all these rich tycoons by surprise, suddenly he has this business model that he can say, oh, actually, these conspiracies definitely are real. They're not made up, and I alone can stop them. So in Chicago, the rich elites begin purchasing major caches of arms to donate to these newly emerging police forces and the state militias, but they also hire the Pinkertons to routinely infiltrate leftist labor organizations, such as anarchists and other trade union groups. We've actually discussed it on a whole bunch of different episodes, because we talked about it on the John P. Altgeld episode, Governor of Illinois, on episode 316. We obviously, in our two-part series from the Lend-Lease series on anarcho-syndicalists, we talked about the Haymarket bombings and the trials of the anarchists. In 1886, they had previously to this been hired by this group of rich Chicago industrialists to infiltrate anarchists. As it became more of a financial imperative for the company to generate revenue, they started to turn toward these clients. Alan Pinkerton published an 1878 report on the 1877 railroad strike that insisted that the strikers, tramps, and communists were manipulating the working class into forming violent secret society labor unions with an ideology of European communism all across the nation's manufacturing communities in what he termed an infection, which he thought had to be stopped like any other disease. He did not acknowledge the material triggers of the strike, which we covered in our episode on the strike, such as wage cuts. People didn't like their wages getting cut. That made them mad. Didn't really have anything to do with tramps and communists. Pinkerton also contended or insisted that the Knights of Labor was a merger of the Molly Maguire's group in Pennsylvania that he had disrupted previously and exiled communards from Paris that had fled the 1871 Paris Commune collapse. But as he transitions the Pinkertons into this role as these sort of infiltration spies reporting on all these vast conspiracies of communists and anarchists and labor organizers and so forth, he actually then starts building up the what might essentially be termed the private army functions of the Pinkertons. And this becomes increasingly important up until the Homestead Strike, at which point national public opinion starts to turn against the Pinkertons. Beginning in 1884, during a strike of coal miners in the Hocking Valley region of Ohio, Pinkerton detectives began to take on their new role as the armed protection details for scab workers brought in to break a strike, which led them into violent clashes with striking workers. By 1888, the Pinkertons had expanded their services to directly providing scab workers as well. Quote, between 1877 and 1892, the Pinkertons took an active part in at least 20 different strikes. In repeated incidents, however, as the book explains, verbal provocations by strikers toward armed Pinkertons resulted in the Pinkertons firing lethally into unarmed crowds. Newspapers and courts tended to hand-wave away eyewitness testimonies as being inherently biased against the Pinkertons specifically. Yeah, I wonder why. Even when other investigating authorities, such as coroners, would argue that no, the Pinkertons were definitely at fault for these massacres or these shootings or whatever happened. Now, in 1887, the Pinkertons shot a teenager in New Jersey who just happened to be there watching some sort of a strike at the docks, and the local police chief did persuade the contracting company to remove the Pinkertons from the situation given the public outcry. But this begins a shift where increasingly the Pinkertons specifically are coming under more and more scrutiny. And this is at this point after the Haymarket incident and the Haymarket trials. The United Labor Party denounced the shadowy quasi-governmental role of the Pinkertons and said, quote, Pinkerton men go from state to state committing murders for which none of them are ever brought to trial, end quote. The Federation of Organized Trades also denounced them by name, and a state trades assembly in New Jersey called them an, quote, army of Hessian murderers, in reference to the Hessian mercenaries of the British Army during the Revolution that had been deployed to New Jersey. And this became a very popular metaphor to them. In fact, one of the chapters of the book just has quote after quote after quote comparing the Pinkertons' armed guard role, which Rachel's going to talk more about, and its parallels to present day, or continuation to present day, that became a very popular thing to describe them as, was Hessian mercenaries. The same trade assembly said that the riches and power of the industrialists, quote, had made them so arrogant that it is only a question of a short time when each one of them will become a feudal lord with his own private department of murder, end quote. Now, that I thought was particularly fascinating as well, because it turns out, as there's a lot of quotes in this book from firsthand sources, this idea during the Gilded Age and the Second Industrial Revolution that these rich guys were becoming neo-feudal lords was a popular talking point at the time, and is something that we hear today as well. The Knights of Labor argued that armed Pinkertons tended to inflame situations, quote, just as a red flag acts on a bull. A common thread throughout the book is how favorable toward the Pinkertons' major newspapers were, especially the New York Times, and how absurdly dismissive they were of any worker objections or even politician and law enforcement objections made toward the Pinkertons. The 1890 New York Central strike started with a very conscientious effort by the Knights of Labor to keep things peaceful, to shake off their growing public reputation of being associated with worker violence. So they sort of had this respectability campaign they were going to do. And this reputation was unfortunately already linked to agitation and attacks by Pinkertons in earlier strikes. But within weeks, in 1890, this New York Central strike had devolved into gunfire on both sides. However, newspapers this time, apart from the still very pro-Pinkerton New York Times, tended to use the phrase Pinkerton roughs and ascribe blame to their violent intervention. Local police attempted to remove or even arrest Pinkerton shooters, and Pinkertons refused to allow this and beat an officer. Workers also alleged that the Pinkertons were engaging in sabotage of railroad property to make the Knights of Labor look bad, while the Knights continued to urge calm and nonviolence, as well as not engaging with the Pinkertons to try to bolster their reputation. The Knights even urged workers not to joke about taking violent action because Pinkerton spies might overhear and have them convicted on false charges. And we're going to talk in part two a lot more about Pinkerton's spies. The Knights of Labor also began a fierce public relations campaign to win over newspapers to the workers and against the Pinkertons, even going as far as to suggest that Pinkertons had a clear financial incentive to create violent chaos because then it would justify giving them more and longer contracts. The Pinkertons contended to industrialists that, quote, all capital so invested is practically at the mercy of secret labor organization whose tyranny and despotism exceed anything ever known in the history of the world, end quote. The Knights responded by arguing that, quote, their existence as a detective agency depends upon their detecting something. In order to prevent the occupations from vanishing, they conjure up the imaginary where the real world would not answer their purpose, end quote. Another quote, there exists no necessity whatever for the existence of a wandering army of vagabonds raked together from the four quarters of the earth to engage in labor disputes. Capital makes a mistake in engaging these vagrants. And that's something that Rachel's also going to talk about when we get more to this issue of private security, is this notion of, like, who are these guys that are being brought in to do this private security? They seem pretty violent. Now, the New York Central strike ended in deep failure for the Knights, particularly when other rail workers in different unions refused to join the strike in solidarity. But state officials in New York were at the very least persuaded that the Pinkertons had probably made the situation worse and that it might be appropriate for the state to step in once in a while to mediate strikes instead of letting them be resolved by uncontrolled private force. So the Homestead strike gets its own chapter in the book because of how profound a shift it brought into the reputation of the Pinkertons. Brutal anti-worker actions at the Homestead Strike of 1892 in Pennsylvania, which we discussed in episode 225, sharply turned much of public and media opinion against the agency. The American Journal of Politics expressed bewilderment that the workers had been charged with, quote, treason for their shootout with the Pinkertons, who were hired by the manager of the steel mill and not working on behalf of the government. As a side note, nobody on either side of the shootout ended up being convicted of anything, including murder. Another writer expressed consternation that, quote, millionaires are permitted to hire and drill the scum of society to shoot down workers. An increasing number of national-level politicians began to worry after Homestead that if Pinkerton thugs regularly inspired armed worker self-defense, as at Homestead, it would inevitably lead to civil war. Congress convened an investigation not just into Homestead, but into the broader questions about whether or not an armed private security force should be allowed to operate unregulated, and whether or not local law enforcement was right to deputize them to act for the government, too. Law enforcement testimony was split between those who openly believed that the Pinkertons exacerbated situations and those who believed that the working classes could only be contained by the explicit fear of the Pinkertons' willingness to use deadly force with little provocation. The House report in this investigation included a majority and minority report. The majority report called the Pinkertons, quote, a mercenary private police force that may properly be characterized as a sort of private military or police force and produce irritation among the strikers, frequently resulting in hostile demonstrations and bloodshed. The minority report stated that, quote, Pinkertons have grown to undue and in some degree menacing proportions with its officers, corps of drilled men, and supply of arms. It is the nature of a military force under the control of private individuals to be hired out to whomever may be willing to engage it. The Senate findings suggested that the mere fact of the now constant reliance on armed Pinkertons demonstrated the state was unable to maintain order when necessary, and that if that was true, then the country was basically already in a state of anarchy. Senator John Palmer of Illinois denounced the Pinkertons as enemies to mankind that ought to be hunted down. Governor Altgeld, as we talked about in episode 316, pardons people for allegedly instigating the Haymarket bombing. Some of them were executed before he was governor, on the basis that the Pinkertons had actually caused the violent clashes at Haymarket. Congress was uncertain as to whether or not it could act federally to ban the use of armed Pinkertons nationwide under constitutional powers interpretations present at the time, but it did pass the first anti-Pinkerton law banning federal agencies from outsourcing to the Pinkertons, as well as banning them in the District of Columbia. However, this was taken as enough of a green light for 23 states to pass their own state-level laws shortly after. And even the pro-Pinkerton New York Times began to raise questions after the disastrous battle at the Homestead Strike, alleging that that the Pinkertons' reserve force of armed guards were generally forcibly recruited for specific incidents among known criminals that the Pinkertons monitored and tracked. The Times also observed that generally after each labor clash, some state legislators in every state had attempted to ban the use of these mercenaries, but the Pinkertons had always managed to stop the bills from passing. The Times also was willing to print a quote from Samuel Gompers of the AFL union, attributing the violence at Homestead to the Pinkertons and denouncing the private mercenary force as, quote, contrary to all American principles and ideas, end quote. Harper's Weekly said, quote, when such an agency also furnishes armed bodies of men for the defense of factories or railroad shops in case of troubles between employers and working men, it assumes a different character. It becomes, in a large sense, a private military organization, keeping itself in a state of readiness to call into active service at short notice. It has a standing corps of experienced officers, captains, and lieutenants, and a body of trained privates large enough to form the nucleus of a little army. Some members of organized labor, however, immediately recognized that the real legacy of the Homestead Strike was not the fall from grace and power of the Pinkertons, but instead the rise of state militias, as well as federal troops, as an explicitly anti-labor force of capital in their place. This had happened at Homestead, but the wave of anti-Pinkerton laws that followed essentially cemented this new function. Now, in our part two, we're going to be talking about the Pinkertons' role in the Mountain West and some of their labor infiltration and spying activities. Rachel is going to talk about how, despite the efforts to reduce the role of the private security functions and security force characteristics of the Pinkertons agency, that has actually continued to a present day.
Yeah. So the modern day Pinkertons were acquired by Securitas, which is a Swedish security agency, in 1999. And in August 2000, they acquired Byrne Security, which is one of their best, biggest rivals in the U.S., and also several regional security companies in the U.S. So these acquisitions made Securitas one of the largest security companies in the world. In 2001, a new organization took effect with five business areas according to types of services offered, and Loomis, Fargo & Company, which you may have seen their money, their armored money trucks, was also acquired. In 2013, Securitas acquired Pinkerton Government Services, which provides cleared security services to governmental agencies and programs that require a Department of Defense or Department of Energy security clearance. This government services division of Securitas became known as Securitas Critical Infrastructure Services. This division operates both in the U.S. and worldwide when cleared services are needed overseas. So operations are still under the brand name Pinkerton. These services include due diligence, background checks, security assessments, brand protection, intellectual property protection, executive protection, investigations, cyber surveillance, computer forensics, social compliance, and IT security. So a lot of these are the modern day investigation services that Pinkerton has provided over the past couple centuries. So in 2018, there was a communication workers strike against Frontier Communications in West Virginia and Virginia, and Frontier alleged that some of its cables were cut with an axe or shot with a shotgun, and that striking workers were driving recklessly, quote-unquote, around work sites. This is from a New Republic article in 2018. So Frontier offered a reward of $10,000 for information about the identity of the vandals, and the company took out a temporary injunction that it said it needed to keep the strike peaceful. In this legal complaint was the news that the company was employing Pinkerton Consulting and Investigations for, quote-unquote, security services, and the Pinkertons claimed that striking workers had, quote-unquote, abused them. This was according to the West Virginia Gazette Mail. The workers disputed these accusations, and in fact, a scab committed the strike's only threat of violence when he pulled out a gun to intimidate strikers. So this article kind of goes into a little bit of the history, but also how they're operating in the modern day. They are intact largely on the strength of their ability to intimidate, surveil, and gather intelligence about workers. On its website, the company advertises, quote, global protective intelligence produced in part by agents who are embedded or on call. Corporate agents can access the Pinkerton Vigilance Network, which consists of the firm's agents, government agencies, and over 1,000 private sources. The goal is to keep help corporations manage risk on all fronts, from natural disasters to political events. It's really easy to see the parallel between the historical actions of the Pinkertons and right through to today. They're still kind of sowing discord. They're painting workers as violent and troublesome and prone to acts of sabotage. So it's kind of scary to see how they're using the old plays from their playbook, and it still kind of seems to work. The New Republic article describes an ad from Securitas and Pinkerton. They list, quote, labor demonstrations among the risks that can monitor. Trouble can happen anywhere, anytime, a narrator intones. I guess it's not quite as out in the open as it used to be, and Pinkerton is now kind of operating kind of in the shadows, but they're still around. They're still trying to, quote, investigate labor organizing and kind of escalating the violence and escalating tensions between workers and management.
Well, next week, as I said, we're going to talk more about some of their other activities in disrupting labor, both past and present. But as you note, there's just so many clear parallels here between the original Gilded Age and our current time. And Pinkerton happens to be one of the literally continuous threads connecting both of those time periods. They have not gone away. And we've got a lot more for you on the Pinkertons. And Rachel's got a lot more research as well to present. But Rachel, thank you for being on for part one this week.
Thanks, Bill.